Hi, welcome to the Neshamas Podcast. We at Neshamas are on a mission to promote mental and emotional health within our community. Among the many ways we do this is by empowerment through education. This podcast is where we get to listen to personal experiences of those who have been affected by mental illness, the pain, the struggle to get better, and today, by the grace of God, have emerged with a message of hope and healing. My name is Moshe Chanan. I am a grateful addict in recovery, and I am a certified life and addiction recovery coach. I'm here to encourage vulnerability and allow for hope to emerge from the internal journeys we share. Please join me, hear the stories of these heroes, and know that you are not alone. Hi, welcome back to the Neshamas Podcast. Today, I am honored to be sitting with Mendy Fuchs. Mendy is 32 years old and was born and grew up here in Crown Heights. He lives in Israel with his wife and four children. Baruch Hashem, Mendy is in recovery from addiction for 1 year, 3 months and 28 days as of today on July 4th. Happy Independence Day. Mendy is actually Shlomi Fuchs' brother, who is also on this podcast. If you haven't heard that episode yet, I encourage you to have a listen. And thank you, Shlomi, for putting us together, if you're listening. Welcome, Mendy.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Very welcome.
I'm Mendy Fuchs. I live in Israel in Kiryat Gat, married, four kids. I came to town for my sister's wedding. Been here last time a couple of years ago. And yeah, I'm just excited to be here. I feel it. I feel it deep inside me. I've spoken before. I never done it in English. I live in Israel for the past decade plus, so my home language is Hebrew these days. So I'll try my hardest. I'm going to have to crack some teeth, but I'm excited. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, I do appreciate it. I acknowledge Shlomi for putting this together and for all the work that he did on himself, also to be as a source of inspiration to you and a source of encouragement for you. And I acknowledge whoever it is that's in your life that is supportive of you sharing your story. I have no doubt, when I've seen it again and again, how people hearing other people's stories of experience, strength, and hope has been so helpful. So, yeah, thank you to the entire team. To get to know you, Mendy, can you just give us a general idea of what it was like growing up here in Crown Heights, whatever comes to you? Just give us a little picture.
I was born in Crown Heights 32 years ago. Truthfully, a lot of parts of my childhood are like erased. There's still like certain things that every time they come up, it's like, I've spoken about these things a lot by therapy. Yeah, I grew up in the house. There was a lot of action in the house all the time. It's like a lot of achnos asorchim. My parents are both teachers. They know a lot of people. A lot of people know them. The house was always like noisy slash wild. That was pretty much the childhood. But at the age of 8, there was the accident. I call it my own Black Friday. Because it happened on Friday, and that like changed my life over there. I was 8 years old. My father fell off the roof, and I was like witnessed. I stood there. Out of all the siblings, I was the only one there. Today, after a lot of therapy happens to me, that was probably the day I lost my sanity at the age of 8. And that started a nice big snowball rolling around the world from then and until about a year ago. When I had to stop that ball of rolling because it was going nowhere. Back to the childhood, yeah, I learned in Oyot Torah from like pre-1A till 8th grade. I don't have any like great moments, probably even good moments from school year. From like 5th grade until the end of 7th grade, I was like a band in class. Those are like most of my memories from my time in school. And 8th grade was like a silent year. Like I remember like not hardly talking to anybody. I was just in my own bubble, just waiting for that year to end, cuz I knew after 8th grade I'll probably leave town. I didn't know what the options were yet, but I definitely knew in Crown Heights I'm not going to continue. Yeah, I remember those years behind the bullying in class. I got beaten up in the streets a lot by kids from class, kids from other class, other grades. I remember pictures, like images of myself hiding in an alleyway for a while, for an hour, until they passed by. They couldn't find me. Only then I can go home. And yeah, it was like living in a nightmare. But that's what I knew back then. And eighth grade was over. And then my mother asked me, where do you want to go to yeshiva? I told her anywhere, just not here. She said, how is Israel? I'm like, it sounds like a plan. We're in Israel. I told her, like, any yeshiva, doesn't matter. Like, I was just waiting to get out of here. And that's what brought me to Israel at the age of 14 and a half, 15. And that's where my Israel journey started. I really thought coming to a new place, a new environment, mentality, language, new people that don't know anything about my life. I really thought it's gonna be the life changer. I had dreams about it, and the few first months were really good. I was the only American in the yeshiva, and I got a lot of attention and a lot of love, and it felt good. And then other plans showed up there. And that's where I started getting, basically it blew up in my face, this whole new country situation, and everything's going to change. So there was this guy in the yeshiva. He was in my grade. He was in my shir. And he did some things to me that didn't have to happen sexually. And I remember how it started, like everybody talks about it, when you freeze at that moment and you can't act in any way, you can't stop it. I was there, yeah, and it just went on for that whole year in yeshiva, and at a certain point it stopped. And there was another guy in yeshiva also, and I'm very sorry for the language, but in rehab, like when I was saying my story, so one of the counselors like told me, like, you were the of the yeshiva, like whoever felt they need to do what they gotta do, so they have an address to go to. I accepted it. Yeah, it was like a word I was looking for years. Like why me? Yeah, something. Continued like scratching me up at the age of a teenager. I was supposed to have a joyful life at that time and go out with friends and everything, and like just another scar on the journey. And I was waiting for that yeshiva to be over, so again that dream could relive itself of starting in a new place, blah blah blah. I was there already once, and I went to a different yeshiva, and everything started fine. New people, no one knows what happened in the other yeshiva. A few days into the season, we call it. So this new guy comes to the yeshiva, and we all come to greet him, and I come to notice that it's the same guy from the other yeshiva that damaged me over there, my soul. Yeah, it was very hard for me to believe what I'm seeing in my eyes. Like, I'm like, okay. This wasn't my plans. It was like right after summer vacation, I came all fresh and a new start. The same things are going on over there. It's not, the details are not, I don't think they're so important. It was just like whatever went on in the first yeshiva, he just continued where he stopped. And it was one Shabbos when I left the dorm, because we were sitting by the meal, and he was like motioning me with his face, like, I'll see you after the meal. And It was just too much for me. I just stood up in the middle of the meal and I ran out of the dorm. I just ran far, far. I went to a park. I was sitting down on a bench over there. And this old guy comes over to me, sees me sitting alone, and he starts asking, what are you doing here? I'm like, well, I just need some air. He tells me, you want to come over? We'll watch some TV. And I'm like, all right, it sounds exciting, you know? I've always kept Shabbos. Maybe it's time to try something different. I went over to his place and he took out some beer. I'm watching TV. At a certain point, he switches the channel to VCR, and a porn movie starts playing over there on the screen. And he's starting to touch me. I stood up and I ran out of the place. He's trying to call me from the back. And this guy, I forgot to say, like, he gave me a tour in his house before. He's like a doctor in a hospital and everything. I'm like, wow, amazing. I just ran out of there and I went back to my dorm and I came to my room. I went under my blanket and I was just crying over there. After a couple of minutes, I hear the door opening and I look and I see that bachur from yeshiva. He's coming close to me. I stood up and I told him, listen, you're going to leave this room now and you're never going to talk to me again. And if you ever come close to me, I'm just going to kill you. I remember I told him those kind of words, the exact words. And yeah, he left and I left yeshiva a couple of months later. He never bothered me again. I was on shlichus and some guy came to the yeshiva, a shliach from Ocean City, Maryland. He's like a friend of the Rosh Yeshiva and whatever. He was with us for a couple of days. It was like winter season when the place is like dead over there. He has nothing to do there. So he comes to Israel for a couple of months. And he was like chilling with us, like telling us stories from his place and everything. And we got like very attached. And he saw I'm basically like wasting my time in yeshiva. And he offered me like if you ever leave this place and you want to do something meaningful in life, go always come over to my Chabad house. I need an extra hand there always. And it sounded excited to me. And I left yeshiva a couple of months later. And right away I reached out to him. And I was on shlichus by his Chabad house for 2 months. And then he threw me out from there. Yeah, I was just a troublemaker probably. Always looking for action. Whatever I was told to do, I always loved doing the opposite. It's part of my nature. Crossing the red lines or walking on the red line, like balancing between right and left. I left the Chabad house and yeah, that's where my journey of my life started actually, where I was in no man land and I just like started working in these random places. Some work lasted for a day, for a month.
How old were you at the time?
What?
How old were you at the time?
I turned 18 in the Chabad house, I remember, in the summer. And yeah, so I was 18 years old and like I was done with schools, yeshiva, just wandering around the place. I worked one day in sushi, and then a week later, I'm already in a pizza shop, and I worked in the mikveh in Eastern Parkway for a couple of months. I went to these random places. I was just everywhere. At the age of 19, 20, I don't remember exactly, I met my wife in Manhattan. She used to work with this very famous lady in Israel. She has these shows for religious women and like in the Jewish world. And they perform all over the place. And they had like a couple of shows in New York. It's like these two comedians and there's a group of like dancers. My wife was part of the dancers. She started there actually when she was like 12 years old. And so she came to New York and I was in Manhattan at that time. And I was with a couple of friends and we were in H&M going shopping. And I heard this girl like calling my name, Mendy. And I turned around and I didn't recognize her. We're like far related, fourth cousin or something. And we had like in our childhood, like we used to go to vacation in Israel every summer until I went to sleepaway camp. And so yeah, we had like memories from childhood. And she asked me like, what am I doing? What are you doing here? And we got to know each other. And then we decided we're just going to hang out together, you know, a couple of Israelis like lost in the forest. So yeah, and then we hung out together, this whole group, and that's where I got to know my wife. And like we stayed like connected like online. Back then it was like Skype, I think they call it. Yeah. So yeah, we're like a long distance connection for like a year. And then I went to Israel with my suitcase and a whole plan. I'm going to move here and start a new life. I'll get married and this and that. And I was there. I landed there and the first day I was there, we went out like on a date and she dumped me over there. And it was a one-way ticket. So I had to call the agent and fly right back. Like I was there for another few days. And I came back here and yeah, this is like the important part because it was like the first time where I was behaving like an addict, actually, when I came back from Israel. I couldn't handle it. It was so unplanned, this situation that happened there. And I came back and I just... I don't remember how I got hooked up with weed, and it was like a whole trip for me. It was for a couple of weeks. I was like blacked out. I don't remember. I remember driving with friends on Shabbos to Niagara Falls, and I was arguing with the police at the border, like with the shliach over there. I was fighting with him on Shabbos. Like everything's blurred by me. Like it was a crazy time. I just remember I was like running away from feeling anything. And that's like where it started, actually. I'm saying the L'chaim business was always around. There was a great feeling of feeling like extreme in like certain moments. And that was like the first time when even in yeshiva, when I was getting damaged over there, like I didn't really run away from it, like towards anything. I didn't have the information back then. I was pretty pure, I would say, whatever was left from me at that point. But this is where the trip actually started, with my addiction. And from that moment, I got to know a new present that entered my life at that moment, where I could do something and not feel, not think. And it was amazing for me at that point in life. And a couple of years later, my wife, back then we weren't married yet, she reached out to me through Facebook. And I was like acting like hard to get at that point. And I knew the moment I answer her, like, we're gonna get back on track where we stopped. Funny thing is, in Israel, after she dumped me, so she took me back to my friend's house where I was staying. And when I exited the car, so I told her, you know, we're gonna get married one day. And she gave me a look like, what are you talking about? And I was very confident with that. Yeah. So I come back. Yeah, I replied to her, and like the connection like revealed itself. And yeah, a couple of months later, I was in Israel already. This time, no one got dumped. And I lived by my grandmother for close to 2 years in the settlement in Israel. And the first year, I was just like an animal, every day going to Yerushalayim, getting high with friends. I was stoned all the time, and clubs, waking up certain mornings. Like, I don't know how I ended up in this place. And every day was my plan was to come back to my grandmother's place, but it didn't always work out. The second year, I got a job through her neighbors. They're like, they had this painting company, and I worked for them for a nice time. Yeah, it was close to a year. And then I went on Shabbos to my wife's house, to her parents' house. And that was like after, you know, we used to date a lot of that time and hang around. And I came over to them for a couple of times. And that Shabbos, like the moment Shabbos was over, like packed my things, I was about to leave. And her parents tell me like, come here, sit down for a second. I remember it was like a round table. I always laugh about the round table. And I sit down and they're like, what's the plan with you two? And I'm like, I don't know, is there any plans? Like, I looked at my wife, is there any plans happening? Like, you guys are planning to get married anytime soon? I'm like, yeah, for sure. When? I don't know. Whenever we get married, we'll get married. So like, you want to get married? So I'm like, yeah. Okay, so let's do it. So I'm like, okay, let's do it. That same night, we closed everything, the photographer, the whole, the band, like, wow. Yeah, that was me back then. Like, if it was up to me, until today, I would be in the same place. Like, I didn't know anything else. Like, everything looked like the end of the world for me. Like, what marriage, what this, what that. But yeah, I'm thankful today that adults back then, responsible people, took it into their hands and did what they had to do. A lot because of them, I'm where I am today, probably. Yeah, so we got married like 3 months after. My whole family flew in to Israel. And yeah, once again, obviously, I say, so this new journey is going to change my life. I don't get sick of that. I always say it again and again. Like, I'm going to forget everything I went through. I have a wife now. We have our own home. We'll have kids in the future. And like, everything is going to be just fine. And yeah, it was always like tense on like in my chest. I always felt it throughout my whole childhood being home. And that was basically my childhood story, because I was going through hell outside of the house in school, on the way back from school. And like, a person wants to know he has one place to feel peace and quiet, and I just didn't have that. I remember myself at the age of 8, 9, 10, I remember myself talking to myself in the mirror, like in the shower. I had like conversations with myself. I was like, I had some younger siblings back then. My sister, which is older than me, she was only a year and a half older than me. And there was no one to talk to. Like, I used to come home with after I was attacked, like, physically and beaten up. And I entered the house, and the only thing I was asked at that point is, why is my shirt tucked out and not tucked in? Like, yeah, at a very young age, I realized there's no one to talk to over here, and it's not there. Like, I have to find myself elsewhere. I always had like these suicide thoughts, always from that young age. Like in school, every time on the way back from school, like I used to, like these thoughts always came back. Like I remember once I had like a fight with a kid in class, and I was always busy with writing these notes and begging them to forgive me. That was like all the years went by like that. I remember once running out of school and I ran to the subway and I told him I'm going to jump to the tracks, and he ran after me. It was like, yeah, deep in my mind, I knew I'm not ready to jump on the tracks yet, but I enjoyed the fact that he was running after me. Like, I just had a little more attention, you know, in school. I didn't have that. So I just tracked his attention. That was my childhood. It was crazy. I was running around town all the time just to feel something, feel existing in any way. And so that was the journey. Like, it just went on, and my situation just got worse and worse. And one day I wake up and it's like, you're married with four kids and the situation didn't get any better. Nothing changed. It just got worse because you have so much responsibility now, and you're just like stuck in a cage. Like, there was one day I looked up to the sky and I'm like, God, like, how am I in this position? Like, how did I get here? And then just like started like trying to rewind yourself, because life is like fast forwarding so fast, and I was trying to stop it, and you just can't. So between the third and fourth child, that's when reality hit me very hard, and I like understood, like, this is my reality, and now I have to see how I'm gonna live with this, because the reality, the way it is, it's impossible to live like this. I didn't know at that point what I'm carrying on my back. It's been years after school, after yeshiva. And I, like, everything was, like, blurry. I buried it so deep inside me. And I haven't spoken about it in years. So, like, obviously, it was a big part of me. I wasn't aware to it at that point. And I was just, like, suffering. I was suffering. I had these panic attacks, like, day after day. I used to wake up at night a lot of times, like, sweating. So at work, I had somebody working there, and he always had weed on him. And at that point, he once asked me, like, you want to come? Let's go chill at work. It was, and I work in this big company, international company, hundreds of workers. We deal with seeds, and everything's very expensive over there. Like, a lot of money being rolled over there, like, daily, and a lot of responsibility. And in the beginning, it looked like, no, I can't do this at work. And yeah, that was like, that lasted for a couple of seconds, and I end up with him. And since that first time, I remember, like, the whole day, I used to like look towards him and wait for the motion of his face. Like, he used to see, like, he used to motion, let's go out now, let's chill. And then from one time a day, it became two times a day, three times a day. And yeah, I started like definitely relying on it, and I was relying on any opportunity I had to run away from my reality. That feeling was like, wow, I really fell in love with that thing. It like, was like a life changer at that moment. And I used to wait, like, from work, I used to come home, and I used to like wander around on my phone, like, who's available now to chill. And I, at that point, I didn't know I have the option to, like, I could take care of this by myself. I don't have to rely on anybody. But I didn't have that thought yet. Like, I was in a place where I could rely on people. And obviously, at that point, I was, like, still hiding it from my wife. The fact that I'm smoking on a daily basis. She knew I chill with friends on the weekend, Thursday night. We watch basketball game together. But she thought that was it. Like, one day, this guy didn't show up at work. And I just needed it. And I was going crazy. I was losing my mind. So I went up to the gas station. I bought a couple bottles of beer, and like I relaxed myself. And then I said like to myself, like, I can't rely on him. He might not come again. Like, I have to start relying on myself. And that was like where it started. Yeah, I started like buying it, and I remember the beginning. Like, I'm gonna smoke this amount a day, and I thought I'm having control over the situation. And it was like a half a joint a day. And I said, I have from the morning until night. This is that's what I have for today. Yeah, after a week, it turned into one and then two and three and four. And I was just stoned all day. I like waking up in the morning until today. I wake up 5 o'clock in the morning. I'm an early morning guy. My therapist always tells me, like, he tells me there's a certain point when the, like, smoking addicts, like, there's a certain point when they can't wake up 5 o'clock in the morning anymore. It's like, it's hard. And he tells me that somehow you managed to do that. And yeah, it went on for a couple of years. Waking up at 5, and when I wake up at this whole ceremony, I have to go to the shower and put hot water on my chest because I wake up with these panic attacks. And then I just started, like, from 5 until, like, late at night. I was like a walking stoner, a driving stoner. There was no rules, no laws in my life. Like, I really lived in this bubble where I thought, like, nobody sees what I'm doing. I really felt like I'm in my own world. And it was like an automatic mode. Like, it wasn't like, there was no control over there. At that time already, it was like, yeah, there was when COVID started. And we had the whole thing, when was it, Pesach? When we had the whole, like, Seder night in Israel, they were, like, very extreme with it. The whole, like, no one leaves their homes on Pesach. No one's going to, no in-laws, no nothing. And that Pesach, being home alone for that whole week with my wife and kids, like, I snatched over there. It was like, wow. That's when I realized how bad my situation is, because I can't sit down for a moment. And, like, on Shabbos, and by that point, I was still, like, keeping Shabbos, and I had alcohol on Shabbos, but at a certain point, the alcohol wasn't for me. Like, I used to get nauseous from it. Like, I used to force myself to drink just to get that high again, you know, and just feel out. But, and then I just felt, you know, like, whatever, I have this, this thing I have from Sunday to Friday, so I could do it on Shabbos also. Yeah, I remember talking to, I think it was Shloimeh also, like, he was telling me, like, these rabbis, you know, what you're doing, don't like hurt yourself for it. It's fine. Like, if it's what's keeping you alive for now, just hold on to it. Like, don't worry about Shabbos. It's pikuach nefesh. Like, it made me feel a little better, you know. Like, it didn't really matter at that point. Like, that wasn't my issue if I'm keeping Shabbos or not. But yeah, then, like, the last 2 years of in the addiction before I came to rehab, it was like 24/7. It was from the morning until the night, all day, from Sunday to Sunday. There was no mornings, there was no nights. I felt like it was like one long day. It went on for 2 years. It was like one long day. I used to rest a couple hours at night. I used to go into bed. I used to feel like the moment I close my eyes, the alarm clock goes on. That was like the feeling. Like, I never slept, really, and I was like a walking zombie. Yeah, so I had that at work also. And there were, like, other things going on at work. That's the only reason why I kept working there. And I work there until today, but it's only because I was told when I left rehab, like, don't do any extreme moves more than what you have to do if you have a stable work. So just stay there for now if you feel safe. And at the moment, I was honest and I felt safe because the people that were involved with me using at work, they weren't there anymore. I was like a plant. You just gotta water me like once in a while so I shouldn't die. But I tried going to like this therapist, and I tried like psychiatrist in Tel Aviv. I remember like he was giving me this treatment with like electric shocks in my brain, and I had to go on a walk after and come back and tell him I'm done and I'm here and I'm there. And I went on for a couple of months, 3 times a week, like, I didn't know what my problem was. I didn't know. I really thought I was crazy. I thought I was mentally ill. Like, I didn't know I was an addict. I didn't know what was going on. And I tried. I tried and I tried and I tried. And after that treatment with that psychiatrist, like, I came to a dead end. I'm like, okay, I tried everything. I tried talking to professionals. I tried making up a story. Maybe it's a problem in my brain. It's not working out. And it's been a while. And I wasn't so religious at that point because when I started smoking on Shabbos. So, like, as an addict, you know, like once you do something, like you just open the faucet, like it just starts spilling out. So it was never like enough for me. So what started with smoking on Shabbos, and I used to go on my phone, and like I lived in my own world. Shabbos was very hard for me, just like that Pesach, because sitting down by a Shabbos table with the wife and the kids and like trying to act like a real moment, it was terrifying for me. I had to be on the move all the time. I had to be in the act all the time and like do something or just be busy with myself on my phone, with my games and my TV shows and in my own world. Like I used to come home from work and I used to go rest for a couple of hours, and I used to wake up when the kids went showering and went to sleep already. And then that's when my day started, like 7, 8 p.m. That's when my day starts. Everybody's out of the living room, out of the kitchen, and I could start. And I went to my ceremony and on the porch and everything. And that's what my life was for those 2 years. Yeah, so back to that point where I realized, like, I tried everything and nothing's changing. It's just getting worse. I remember even lying to the psychiatrist. He's like, I don't know, he decided it's a problem in my brain, but somehow I came there to let go of the smoking, the weed all the time. And until today, I don't exactly know what's the connection between the both, but like he used to ask me like after a week. So now we went down to 3, and I used to tell him, yeah. And really I went up to 4 and to 5. Like it was always going, the numbers are going up. Like there was no control over there.
When you say numbers, you're talking about like,
How many joints or grams I smoke a day. He was trying to make me stop smoking, but I was really smoking more. Like the more I went to treatments by him, that's like I was smoking even more. And the lies I told him, I had to tell my wife also, because if not, then we're just like spending money for no reason. But again, I had to make her feel like secure, like Mendy's doing something to change the situation. But deep inside, I knew like it's getting worse. And I knew it's a matter of time until I'm just going to quit this thing. Like, I'm not going to him anymore. The energy of driving an hour to Tel Aviv and looking for a parking place. Like, the money of the treatment didn't bother me as much as the journey I have to do in order to go until I get the treatment. That point, I remember I was sitting home and I couldn't go to work anymore. It was like for a month and a half, I sat at home and I didn't exit my house. Like, I didn't go to the supermarket. I didn't go to shul. I didn't go anywhere. I just sat at home, like rottening over there, and I slept in my own room at that point. Like, I just couldn't be around people at all. And, there was that point. It's been a while. I always had this special relationship with the Rebbe. Like, I didn't always look at him like the Rebbe, like everybody looks at him. It was like something very, like, a deep spiritual feeling inside me. Like he accepts me the way I am. And my grandmother used to tell me stories about an uncle that used to like write him letters in his own language, not like everybody writes letters. Like he used to talk to Rebbe like he's his friend, and that story was always stuck in my head. Like and I felt like that also. Like the Rebbe, me and Rebbe are very close. So it was that day when I just like felt like I'm losing it. Like I felt like I'm dying. I was like a walking dead man, and I just look at that picture in the living room we have. I said, like, I'm gonna hold the Igros Kodesh because I had no energy to sit down and write. It was like too much for me, and I just held the Igros Kodesh and I put it on my chest, and I looked at the picture of the Rebbe. I'm like, Rebbe, yeah, I just spilled everything out to him. I told him like whatever I've been through lately, and I tried everything, and you know, it's like it's time to like let go, like. The way I felt at that point, I really had that strong feeling that I can't hold on to it for a longer time than even a couple of days. Like I really, it was that point when the kids used to come home from school. I didn't leave the house at that time, but they used to come from school and I used to look at them and I had like tears in my eyes because inside of me I felt like I'm telling them goodbye from far, like, and I was telling the Rebbe, you know, like, I need something, like, extra. Like, I tried everything. Like, it's not going to happen. Yeah, I'm feeling it. I open the Igros Kodesh, and the Rebbe starts off, like, it's been a while since we've spoken lately. You're, like, probably busy with your things. And, like, that shocked me. I'm like, okay, that's a good start off. We're going to get into it now. And, yeah, it was, like, a whole letter over there, but the the important part of the letter when the Rebbe is telling me, like, you have to take care of your soul. Once you take care of your soul, the gates of heaven are going to open up. Sha'ari shamayim mipatchu. That's what was written. Like, I saw it, I started crying. Like, I called my wife from the room. I showed it to her and she was crying also because, like, she was part of the journey, like, trying to get me out of it. And I remember we were watching this thing on TV, and we saw like someone talking about rehab. He was saying his story, and I related to so many things he said. And I'm like, and I was waiting for like, what did he do at then? Like, how did he take care of himself? And then he said he went to rehab. And I remember like a lot of times people would tell me like, you're an addict, and I didn't agree with them because it wasn't enough for me, like. I didn't know what an addict is back then. I thought an addict is someone that smokes or drinks or gambles or whatever. Like, but I knew deep inside me, like, that's not my problem. And if I admit that I'm an addict and I'll give my drug or my alcohol or whatever it is away, I'll be stuck with nothing. Like, so I'm not an addict. Like, don't take that away from me. But when I watched that thing, and he said that he went to rehab, whatever, and I went to this place. I'm like, yeah, I want to go to rehab. And like, this is like a daily thing. It's not the closed place you're talking about. I'm like, what do you mean this closed place? So like, yeah, it's like this place you have to go to. You have to be there for like a minimum a half a year, 9 months, a year. It really depends on your situation. I'm like, what do you mean 9 months? Like, in a closed place? He's like, yeah. So I'm like, no, I can't. So she asked me, like, when is the last time you used? So I told her, like, right outside over here before I came in. She said, okay, so you have to go home and clean yourself for 2-3 weeks, 21 days, and come back here. So I started laughing. Like, I can't stop for like a half hour. I don't know how I'm going to bring 21 days. Mm-hmm. And so she's like, there's this thing, like, it's like this mini hospital. They call it Ishpuzit.
Detox, right?
That's detox, what we have, yeah, yeah, yeah. So she's like, go look for, like, go check online for, like, these detox places and start from there. So, okay, we came home and we like entered like in Google. We were searching for like these detox places, and the first place that came out, it's called like Acheret Baderech, like
the last place on the line.
Acheret Baderech is like different on the way. It's like the same way, just different. That's like the explanation of the words. Like, later on, you understand. It's like it's your same life, but like in a different way. And that was the thing, like a different way. And that was the first, there's like so many of them in Israel, but that was like the first one that like jumped up by the search. And it happens to me, it's like a more like a religious place. And at that point, I wasn't really looking for something special. I was just looking for a detox. Like, I'm doing what they're telling me to do. I came there for like a visit, like tour around and see the place. And it happens to me, like, I know the manager.
How did that happen?
Huh? No, it's this woman, like, from years ago when I came to Israel. So we used to, like, chill around. We had, like, a group of people. When I was talking about that time when I came to Israel the first year, I was, like, a walking stoner. And she was part of that group. And later on, it happens to me, like, she married somebody and he was an addict. And, like, later on in life, she opens up this place because she really loved her husband. And, like, she got to this point where she knew, like, either she loses him or she's going to fight for him. And the way she was able to fight for him was when she, like, really got into this whole world of the addiction and she learned it from scratch. And later on, she opens up this detox place. And so I see her and I'm like, wow, this is pretty crazy. It's a smaller world than what I knew. The world is small, but not that small. And so she was telling me, yeah, it was Tuesday. She told me like it could be we're like full like, over here now. The place is packed. You can be able to come. There might be a place available tomorrow, and it might be in a month. Like, I can't really tell you. It depends. I'm like, whatever. I like the place looked like fine to me. I didn't know where I'm coming to, but looked okay. Like, the guys were like nice, and the counselors giving me hugs and everything. It was like pretty new to me, and. So yeah, I came. I remember I went back, and Thursday she calls me and she tells me on Sunday we're starting. Like, you're coming on Sunday, And those 2 days between Tuesday and Thursday, I felt like so lost, like, because I knew like I have like something now, and like, what am I supposed to wait for an answer for them or look for a different place where I like that place? But now I'm stuck and I have to wait like and like suffer more until she gets back to me. But like, yeah, it was only 2 days. And that Shabbos between that Thursday and Sunday, we had a whole family, my wife's family. We went to a hotel in Sfat, and it was like my in-laws, like a 50 anniversary. It was like, they call in Hebrew, the golden wedding, Chatunat Hazav. So we went to the hotel, and that Shabbos in the hotel was, wow. It was such a long Shabbos, but it was my goodbye party. I'm saying, like, I wasn't really like sitting down with anybody. I was in my own world over there. Like every half hour, I left the hotel and came back to the hotel. But yeah, that was my goodbye party. I remember on Friday going to the Arizal's mikvah, and it's like very cold. It's like ice, and I jumped in. I'm like, wow, this is like, we're starting a journey. Like I felt something coming close. And I didn't know what to expect even. Like I didn't know where I was going. But yeah, Sunday showed up right away. And I remember that last joint on my porch before I left to rehab. I was holding the joint. I was crying. It was time to say goodbye. And I came to rehab and to the detox place. And like I remember coming in 12 o'clock in the afternoon. And the counselor there, he tells me, you have like 3 days off. I'm like, what do you mean by 3 days off? He's like, go to bed, sleep, chill, like, calm down. So I told him, I didn't come in for any days off. Like, I had a whole bunch of days off in the past couple of years. So yeah, I'm just ready to do whatever has to be done over here. Say, okay, so come join the group. And I come to the group, and like, I remember that moment. Like, it snapped in like a second. I caught it, and I'm like, wow. It was like an hour into detox. And something in my soul, like, felt like I came home. Like, that it was like a home feeling. I never felt that before. Not in my own home with my wife and kids. Like, my soul, like arrived to a safe place. And, like, the hours went by and the days went by. And I, after, like, a couple of days, like, I landed, like, because, yeah, it went out of my system at a certain point. Like, I started catching on to, like, very fast. Like, I realized I was very aware of what was happening between me and myself and what was happening around me. And I realized, like, I hear a lot of stories around me of people that are there for 3-4 months. And it was scaring me. I felt inside me, like, if I'm going to stay there for too long, it's going to be, like, a new trauma I'm going to have to hold on to. And I came here to deal with, like, all the traumas that came from. And, like, how am I going to do it? So I was fine with the fact that they took away my phone and I'm like disconnected from the world. It was great. And everything they did there was like perfect. They're very big professionals, from the counselors, all the staff members, the social workers, those psychodrama. They had like everything over there going on there.
This was just the detox?
Yeah, it's like a mini rehab place. As I said, like my miracle was, when we searched on Google for detox, this place showed up because it's like a mini rehab place. A lot of people come there for like detox, and then after like a few weeks, they go to rehab, like Ritorno in Israel. You probably heard of that place.
I worked for them for, yeah.
What?
I worked for them for a bit. Ritorno? I went to visit.
So like it really depends, like very individual situation, but certain people come there and at the entrance, they know like this person's going to be here for 21 days, his system's going to be clean, and we're going to send him to Ritorno after. Other situations, it was like a mini rehab. Like, people were there for, like, 3 months, 4 months, and then they have this, like, they continue their treatment, like, they come back, like, that's what happened to me at that point. I'm skipping. Basically, it was an extreme journey. We had, like, twice a week a phone call for 5 minutes with the families, and that part used to kill me, like, I was clean after like 2 weeks that I was sober. Like I started feeling things like very extreme. Mm-hmm. And I haven't felt like this since like years ago. I was always busy, how not to feel. And those short phone calls, like with 4 kids, like you have really time to say hi and bye. And then you have the counselor like standing next to me, and like he's motioning to me like you have to end the phone call. And I hear the kids like crying in the background, like, Abba, Abba. And like, I'm like, wow. There was a point where, like, I didn't want to do those phone calls anymore. And Tuesdays was visiting days. They used to come between 4 and 6. And again, it was like every time 6 o'clock, and they're all like on the floor crying and pulling by my feet. And like, it was
literally
like,
my story.
What?
Literally my story. Like, for me, it wasn't in rehab, it was in the psych ward. And I had one of my son, when they came to visit, and they were trying to leave, and my son was holding on to my leg. Wow. It was like ripping apart.
Yeah, that's the power of recovery. That's what took over me at the end. So towards the end of the, towards like the end of the month, the first month, like there was this guy there. He always used to get me like on my nerves inside, and he used to tell me, "Yo, you're rushing. You're gonna be here for a long time." Like, it was very hard for me to hear that. Like, and thank God, like, there was a big miracle there. Because my process was like going, it wasn't going fast as much as it was going like the right direction. Because they always used to say like, don't try to hurry this up, because it's not going to work. And like, I remember like these other people, like they used to like bother in the middle of the meetings and the therapy groups that were going on there. And I used to lose my temper there. Like, I used to like, stop it. Like, we want to like, and the counselor always used to tell me like, you didn't come to college over here. This is a place where people come, they work on their problems. Like, at a certain point, yeah, I got it. And I really 24 hours a day over there, except for those couple of hours I slept at night. Even in the afternoon, it was resting time. I never went to rest. Like, I spent every minute in that place, like, connecting to the right people and hearing other people's stories and what they were doing in the place there for the last couple of months. They were there. To make a long story short, a few days before the month was over, I went to the manager over there, and I told her, like, I can't stay more than a month. She told me, you can't leave here after a month. It's way too early. And basically, like, my wife got the... There are parts in the rehab where the staff have to do their manipulations behind the scenes in order to, like, keep the guy over there. Because if not, no one's forcing anybody to be there. Like, at any point, you could just stand up, take your things, and leave. So, like, they know how to do it behind the scenes, like, through the other part of the couple, if the person's married, or through the parents, if it's the child over there. Like, and then it gets to that point where the guy says, I'm leaving. So they tell him, leave. And he goes out with his bags, like, in a whole dramatic way, and then he has to pick up the phone. Someone has to come pick him up. And then they realize over the phone that no one's coming to pick them up, and they have nowhere to go. The house is closed, basically. And not for all parents, it's easy to do it, but they're told to do it in order to save their child's life, obviously. The whole manipulation thing, it got to my wife, and I remember that phone call. When I was telling her, like, are you going to come pick me up? And I think, yeah, it was Tuesday. Again, it was Tuesday. You'll come pick me up. And that was the Friday. That was on Thursday. I mean, you come pick me up on Tuesday. The month is over. She's like, no, you have to stay there for another 2 months. And I couldn't accept it. Wow. And that's like, after almost a month in the place, that's when I broke. Like, that's the first time today in the program, we learned a lot about it. That's the first time when I felt that I have no control. Like, it's over. Like, all those days when you had full control, you do whatever you do, whenever you want to do, it doesn't matter if it's your fault or not. But that was like the first time when I hit like that bottom when I felt like, oh, this is over. Like, Mindy, now she decides what's going to be with you. And I felt like a prisoner. Like, when am I getting out of prison? And basically what happened behind the scenes, I didn't know, but they came to me Friday morning and they told me, you could go home for Shabbos. Okay. I remember I went home for Shabbos, and it was an amazing Shabbos. Like, my wife was surprised because she saw a different reality from who I am when sitting down. Obviously, yeah, it's like a one-day thing. You can't really tell the story in one day, but she saw a different Mindy in real than what she was hearing behind the scenes about me. And it's something like she holds on until today. It's funny because today I work for this place. I'm a counselor there. And like, she's still holding on that thing like against the manager. Like, but I try telling her, they do it for the right reasons. Like, I'm in the position today to understand exactly why it's done. Like, don't hold anything like against her. It's like she knows exactly what she's doing. And yeah, whatever. So that Shabbos like changed the whole story. Like after that Shabbos, she told me, I'm gonna come pick you up on Tuesday. Until today, I'm told like by my therapist, he's the same therapist. Like I still go to him like once a week for therapy. My sponsor, the manager today I work for, they always like remind me how that month by me was like very it was very unknown in that place. Like it doesn't happen.
It's not normal.
It's not normal. Like. But I didn't speak out of my ego, not then and not today. Like I really felt that between me and myself, I felt like I went through a lot of the process of the first and second step even before I went to rehab without knowing that I'm doing it. Like I was really in a surrender mode. Like because the moment they took it away from me, I never looked back at those things since then. And I'm always busy like with like after first and second step, like I walked in with my hands up, like I surrender. Again, this is the language I learned later on, the whole program and everything. But like when I look back, I understand. Like I entered rehab not by force. It was like my last option. Like I really tried everything else. Like in my mind, I knew this thing has to work. If not, I don't know. Like there's no other options anymore. Like what didn't we try? So yeah, obviously, like the day I was there, I surrendered because I accepted the fact I'm an addict because they said some very powerful things there I never heard before from like regular people on the streets when they tell you you're an addict and then they turn around and they continue walking. So these people, professionals, they tell you you're an addict, but they explain it in a very clear way. Who's an addict? Like what's addiction? And when I learned for the first time that not drugs and not alcohol, they're not my problems. Like, it's the result of my problems. That's when that big, like, stone comes off my chest. I'm like, finally. Like, that's when I felt like, okay, someone understands me now. And I remember those days on the porch, those dark nights, like, very dark nights. And I used to beg, like, send someone, one person that would really, like, understand me and feel what I'm going through without judging me and deciding and talking for me. And like I asked for one person and I come to this place and I see there's a whole army of people over there. Like we're all the same. It doesn't matter what you use and when you use and how much you use. It just matters why you use. And that was like the only thing I had to like learn and feel and sit down in a group in the rehab place and like people are sharing their stories and like it's like from every person talking like you take like wow I had exactly that same thing in life and I went through that thing and they give you the confidence and the ability to talk for yourself also because I tell today to, also to people that are like sober but they're not always they don't go to therapy so it's like being sober but you're like suffering inside because again that was that thing when you take okay, you took what I had, and now I have like an empty spot inside. I have to fill it up with something else. So if you're only taking it and I'm leaving it empty, so it doesn't last for a long time. That's the truth. So when I see like sober people like suffering, and always reminds me, like there's always one thing I tell them, like it's always, you also have to come to the meetings or just have, in Hebrew they say it, chavrusa. It's like, it's another recovering addict. Because only a recovering addict can understand a recovering addict. Only an addict can understand an addict. Because I paid that price so many times also before I went to recovery. And it happened a lot of times after. Like I had to learn it that you can't share your things with anybody. It doesn't work like that. Like not everybody understands you. And in the beginning of the journey, when someone didn't understand me, like it used to drive me crazy. I used to call my sponsor right away, like I said, and he answered me back like that. And he's like, chill. Like, remember, not everybody's going to understand you. Your wife is not going to understand a lot of things in the beginning of the journey. And as I'm sober, like, it took me like a half a year to like hit into me to understand. Like, I tried, even as a sober guy, I tried for the first half year to change everybody around me because I came with the thing. Like, I have the message now. Like, everybody has to do this. Like, it's a life-changing. And I tried bringing recovery into the house, like, by force. It didn't come in, like, naturally, you know? Like, everybody in this house has to recover now. And I wanted to hang up the signs with all the sentences and all the meanings from rehab. And like, I was living it. And then I remember someone told me, it's like, we always try to change like the world around us, and we can't change people really. But when you change yourself, the people around you are going to change by themselves. Like, it's like, it's contagious. And I took that inside me, and I remember, like, yeah, also back then when I was using, like, who was I attracted to? Who's attracted to me? People that are in the same sickness. We have the same disease. And when you recover, who are you attracted to? Who's attracted to you? It's like the same thing, because this is like really something like that comes deep out of the soul. An addict, his problems, or the recovering situation. It's like, it's something so deep. It's not like something physical, really. Like the, you come to rehab, they take your thing away from you. After a week or two, it's over. Like, what now? Oh, now we're starting rehab. Now we have to get to the roots. We have to get to everything. We start from day one, and like life becomes like so real. And until today, I work a lot on like having regular, normal conversations with like regular people. It's not natural for me. I'm always looking for that intense and that action of the, like, it has to be real. Like, and not everybody's like that. Like, people could be real, but they don't get, like, not everybody talks about their problems. And even people that have it, they're not so like open, like the way I live today at the meetings. Like, you know, I know 8 o'clock in Israel time, 8 p.m. I have my meeting, NA, 3 times a week. I come there. We have Tfilat HaShalva in the beginning. Then we have the things we read. And I know we have like 1 hour and 10 minutes, whatever's left of the time. And you can just like, and I already know, like, it makes me laugh today, because it's like almost every time I go to a meeting, like before, I have like that, those voices in the head, like, ah, you don't have to go today, you're tired and this. And like, and I know those voices already. Like, I grew you up, you know, like, it's my head. And like, as they said in rehab all the time, like the head says stories, and getting yourself into that self, what is it called?
Self-absorbed?
Rikuzatsmi. Whatever. It's like self...
Self-sabotage?
Centered.
Self-centered.
Yeah, you were close. So I know like one of the enemies I'm dealing with is that self-centered situation, because like... I'm always told, like, until today, like, you're allowed to do it, like, for a little bit during the day. It's like, it's calming down, because you don't have anywhere to run away to, really. So it's like, it's your way of, like, how to connect to yourself. So it's fine. But if you see, like, you're, like, getting lost over there, so you have to be, like, very aware. So I know when I get into that situation, like, being self-centered at that moment, like, I had, and now I have, like, an empty spot inside. I have to fill it up with something else. So if you're only taking it and I'm leaving it empty, so it doesn't last for a long time. That's the truth. So when I see like sober people like suffering, and always reminds me, like, there's always one thing I tell them, like, it's always, you also have to come to the meetings, or just have, in Hebrew they say it, chavrusa. It's like, it's another recovering addict. Because only a recovering addict can understand a recovering addict. Only an addict can understand an addict. Because I paid that price so many times, also before I went to recovery, and it happened a lot of times after. Like, I had to learn it, that you can't share your things with anybody. It doesn't work like that. Like, not everybody understands you. And in the beginning of the journey, when someone didn't understand me, like, it used to drive me crazy. And I used to call my sponsor right away. Like, I said, and he answered me back like that. And he's like, chill. Like, remember, not everybody's gonna understand you. You're why. It's all the result of our problems, the addiction. It doesn't really matter what you're addicted to. Doing like the process and working on ourselves through the 12 steps. It's the same process. Only like when we get into like very like deep details, so then people say the parts of the story, so they sound a little different. The addiction part, not the problems part. All of our childhoods, and like most of us, not everybody, like. But yeah, I obviously feel more at home, I would say, in my NA groups. We're more related. And like everybody, when I was at the meeting here, like everybody was saying, like, my name is, and I'm an alcoholic. And like, I didn't really feel comfortable, because I did drink alcohol, like, but that wasn't like my main thing. And And no one said anything else. And like, I don't know. I just didn't say anything. Like, I wanted to say how many I'm an addict. Like, I didn't, whatever. It was my first meeting here. And then I just didn't feel like the as much as open and comfortable like I am by my home meetings. But the environment was amazing. And I'm used to sitting down with 15, 20 people maximum, very small meetings. And you have like a lot of time to, each one has like 10 minutes to share. And like, it's like, wow, it's different a little bit. And like I sat in this huge hall, there's like over 100 people there. And I came with my sister and she was telling me this is actually like pretty small, like compared to other places. And I'm like, okay, this is pretty big. Like there's no meetings like this in Israel. But the energy, that it's like the shelter of the soul. Like you walk into that place and you feel secure, you feel safe inside. It doesn't matter. Like there's nothing bad's gonna happen to you over here. Bad as in like even feelings or thoughts. Like everything's like on pause situation when I sit in a meeting. Because there's too many things happening and you relate to too many things, so you're like your thoughts like are like on the side at that moment. Like you don't think about anything, just recovery mode. And so I'm happy I did. Going to a meeting in Crown Heights is it's a very big closure for me. Like I know like my journey of my problems and my traumas and what I would like turn to be later on in life. Everything started over here, and coming back here and going to a meeting here is, wow, it was very exciting, and it meant a lot to me. And being honest is, yeah, even my visit here now in this place, Crown Heights, inside, like my soul, it's not everything smooth inside. I have a lot of feelings. The last time I was here, it was like 4 years ago, I wasn't sober. I was stoned and I didn't feel anything. Like, and I knew why I have to be stoned. I walk around here, and now it's like the first time. There's always the first time when you're sober to everything. Because like anything you'll do, even like putting a laundry, like everything you do for the first time, it's like you really feel it's the first time doing it. Because back then I had to use before I did anything like. To talk to somebody, I have to use before, and that's what you're using all day, because you're always doing something. So if it's like showering the kids or putting them to sleep, or like, wow, my nightmare was my wife used to call me, like she only said my name, like Mandy. I'm like, oh no, and I have to like do my ceremony, and then I have to come to her, and like she'll be like, could you just put like a white laundry inside? Like, oh, that's it. Like I always thought like the worst is happening. Now she started another conversation of my situation and why, where, what, when. Yeah, so being back in Crown Heights I walk down Kingston and I see faces of people and signs and Kingston Pizza, and everything for me is like, everything has a story behind it. Everything has the time, like Kingston Pizza. That time in school, like I remember I used to like, I had to steal money from my mother's wallet so I can buy things for certain kids in my class. So like, they would be like my bodyguards. Every time it was like one same person, and I had to buy him off. So after school, I had to take him to pizza. So he would stand next to me, and he was like a strong guy. Like no messes around with him. So yeah, it would cost me like to feel safe. Had to cost money, and at that age, I had no job at that point, obviously. So I'm saying like every like sign. On Kingston, every like person I see, going on the subway, Manhattan, and like it, I feel it deep inside. But I know this is what recovery is all about. Start feeling, and as I know today, I have no control over my feelings. I can't control what I'm gonna feel and when I'm gonna feel it. The only thing I could control is how I'm gonna react to it. Obviously, I don't react over my feelings, because the nature of me, I'm very impulsive. I always know like the first thing I'm going to say, if I don't breathe very well before, it's probably going to be a wrong move. It's probably the wrong thing I'm going to say. So I learned how to like react to situations very calm and slow. And if I have to, I always have the option to pick up the phone. Basically, being in recovery is like walking around with like a virtual toolbox. Like every situation I bump into, like I know I have to stop for a moment. I have to open up that toolbox and I have to use the right tools in that situation. And everything's going to be fine. Like, I have some days that they feel very dark. And then I have that tool that tells me, like, it's okay not to feel okay. Don't pressure yourself. Every day has only 24 hours. Don't worry. Like, this day is going to have to come to an end. And tomorrow's going to be a new day. You're probably going to feel better tomorrow. And there's certain days like that. You know, I'm in the beginning of a process. And I know. Every day is another day of opening up more things. Every time I think like I've reached that part where like I have nothing else to deal with, yeah. A new package comes, like in the delivery, like, good morning. It's a new day, new problems, new things to talk about. And yeah, we had our Five Alive group yesterday. We have a Five Alive group in our family.
Can you tell everybody what Five Alive?
Oh, Five Alive is amazing. Basically, my brother Shlomi, he brought this from his place, probably from Yoske, as far as I know.
Yoske what?
Yoske Levin, yeah. Very special guy. And our family, like in a lot of other homes around this area, his spirit lives deep inside our house.
In my family, we have one for the siblings, one with my parents, wow. And I have one with my wife.
Wow. Amazing.
Yeah. So we'll explain what is Five Alive. I mean, there's so many different versions, mm-hmm. But what do you guys do? What's like the format?
The format of R5 Alive, basically it's a little different because each one of us live on like a different side of the universe. So we have Israel, California. It was in the, what's it called? In the Poconos. Now it's going to be Baltimore probably. And New York. So it's the four of us. And yeah, they started it off back then. Two of my brothers, it was like a one-on-one. And then they added another sister. And it happens to me like they offered me the, like if I want to join them. And lucky me and lucky them, lucky all of us that it happened, me being sober at that point. Because if they would have given me that option before, there's no way it would happen. I wasn't talking to anybody then. So yeah, like each thing comes at its time. And that was the right time for it. And it was like, I didn't know what I'm getting into. And the beginning was like a little weird because I'm used to sitting at meetings almost every day. It's like, it's another meeting for me, but then it got like special. So, okay, my meetings I'm used to is like, it's like only like a recovery and like people talking and everything. But yeah, the three or four of us, three out of the four were recovering addicts. So mostly, yeah. Two of us are like very recovering addicts and one is her own journey, and yeah.
So what did the Five Alive look like? You get on a call, Zoom, what?
We do Zoom. It's like a WhatsApp video, actually. And we have that hour, and we split it into four. And we have that younger brother. He's like the youngest. It's funny. But he has a lot of time for it, so he's like on the time thingy. And whoever comes late has been like a note from the parents, like, why you came late? He's scary, yeah. So we can't come late to the Zoom. It's good. We need someone in charge, cause yeah, we could get lost very fast. Like I'm doing in this conversation a lot of times. Basically, each one has their 15 minutes. We divide the hour into four, and you could just share, talk. It's your time. Everybody else goes in silence mode, and you have 15 minutes just to talk, whatever you want to talk about. Feel comfortable. It's like you have a format of people, which are your siblings, and everybody's like willing to listen to what you have to say. It doesn't matter what you're going to talk about, and we accept it. And there's no coming into the conversation in the middle. When someone talks, only he talks. And you could pause your time in the middle, and then the rest of the time like comes back to you later. It's good because me and my brother Shlomi, we had our on and offs like relationship. Like he's always close to me. We grew up together, and I had a sister that, yeah, also we had our on and offs. Being an addict is something very hard to keep a connection with people. So again, yeah, at a certain time, the connection with her also got like lost. Then there's the younger brother. Now the Five Alive basically got me to a place where I could really like know my younger brother, because I didn't know him at all. He was born when I was in yeshiva. And since then, like, I was, like, coming home, like, in and out, like, every half a year for a couple of weeks. And later on, I got even, like, less. And you know, your youngest, your baby brother, 17 years old, and you don't know anything about him. Like, you know, his name is Sean, okay? And that's what we used to call him when he was younger. And that's it. Like, he likes working out, whatever. And, like, over here, you get to hear people. Like, each one has their 15 minutes. And you know what? Your siblings, it's not friends. It's, like, your family. And you know exactly what your siblings have been through in the past week. And it does its effect. Like, it connects. That's the platform. The platform is to connect the family. Slowly, we're seven siblings, and they started off by two, and they went up to three, and now we're four. Time comes, and we're all ready. We want to add another sibling, and hopefully the day comes where we're all connected. Each one has their own journey and their own place where they live in, and it's important because I've seen families that are not connected, and the effect doesn't end between the siblings. It goes on to the other generations as well. Their kids and their grandchildren, and I could see it. I could see it in the larger family where I came from, not my siblings, but my cousins. Like, when the aunts and uncles don't have a normal relationship between them, a stable relationship, at a certain time, it affects the relationship between me and my cousins as well. And that's a fact. And so it's very important for us to stay connected. And it's like, we're all, yeah, it's been a long time. It's been years where everyone did his own thing. And like, none of us like really knew. Like, we used to hear rumors about our siblings. Like, I heard my sister lives in California today. Like, I didn't talk to her for a while. Like, I don't know, maybe she does it. And it's sad. I'm saying it's your siblings. So it's a very blessed platform. And hopefully we'll grow through that to connect all the siblings and the other kind of 5-11, which you brought up with the parents. It's like a whole different journey, but hopefully we'll get there. Like, being in rehab and recovering brought me to a place where it's the first time like I'll allow myself to talk to my parents, and when I understand that I'm not looking to blame anybody anymore. And there's certain things that probably can be fixed. And some of them can. And whatever can be fixed, I accept it. And it gave me the ability to get out of myself and my ego and always look at me and myself and I, and to realize that each one of them, my father and my mother also, they had their own journey. My father grew up in a house of Holocaust survivors, and my mother grew up in her own house where I think there was a lot of violence going on there. But they have their effect in life as well. And as a child, yeah, there's certain things we can't rule that off at. But the fact that I could look at them and, you know, loving is a whole different thing. As you say in Hebrew, you can't buy love in the supermarket. It's not for sale. Something you have to build from, but I'm working on it. I forgive. The reason why I forgive today is I live in a position where I always remember more things I've done to other people. And obviously in the place where I'm standing now in life, I really want to be forgiven. So when you're in a position where you understand at that point, okay, we went through that process in therapy already. When you understand, like, everything you did at that point probably wasn't your fault, and you were like an out of control, insane. But after you pass that point in therapy, there is that point where you start taking responsible also for certain things you did to people. If it was my wife or other people that surrounded me at younger age or older age, like, there was always an effect of what I've been through in life, and, you know, the wheel comes around. And yeah, so when you're in that position, when you know, like, you want to be forgiven, so it's much easier from there to forgive other people after what they've done to you. And so, yeah, so it's day after day. The relationship with my parents obviously started from my kids, you know, it's the grandparents. There wasn't a day where I said I'm going to disconnect the relationship between my children and their grandparents. It's not my choice to make. Like, they'll grow up, they'll be adults, they can do whatever they want. Like, I can't take that thing from them without, you know, it's not right. And I knew that after I got married already. Like, it's been a long time. There was a time when I didn't talk to my parents in years. And after I got married, when the kids came, like, it started, like, we started having these, like, weird conversations, like, through the kids. Like, you have to call on Friday and say good Shabbos and everything. So you have a couple of words with your parents. But, yeah, until today, like, with my mother, it gets easier. My father, like, the conversation can go on for more than 30 seconds. Like, it's not. It just, so, okay, I'm fine with it. I don't fight it. I don't have to say, like, why does it have to be like that? And why can't I? No, I'm past that point already. I accept it. And hopefully, you know, one day it can change. But the most important part of the recovery is just when you learn to accept situations. Like, a lot of times, like, there's a situation happening, I accept it. And if it's hard, you know, I have to, like, pass it on to higher power. Like, it's not in my control. Or in other words, like, I used to, even being sober in the beginning of the journey, like, these things used to happen. And, like, my first instinct would be, like, why does it have to happen to me? What did I do wrong? Like, again, going back to that same place where everything's happening to me and I had to work on it. And it took a while. And today, like, when these kind of things happen, if I get a flat tire or I'm stuck in traffic and I'm rushing somewhere, like, I don't do that thing again. Like, why does it have to happen? Why is he punishing me again? Like, everything for me today is a lesson. And I brought it down to that level where I have a flat tire. And it happened to me a few months ago in Israel on the way back home. And, like, I stop and I ask God, like, what are you coming to teach me now? Like, I retake everything as a lesson. Could be something that for me, like, I have to work on my behavior still and how I react to situations without being impulsive. Like, everything has its own lesson, or it could be other reasons we understand today that God does what he does, and sometimes we get to understand why, even if it's 10 or 20 years later. But a lot of times we don't get to understand why, and we just have to put our trust to it and understand that whatever he does, he has his own reasons. Like, I've learned that through my life story. Like, you know, what you see today, maybe you'll see the result in 20 years from now. Maybe.
Right. I didn't get many questions in. I'm okay with that. But I do have a lot of questions, but I'm so happy you just went on a flow. And ultimately, like, my position is really to just facilitate your share. So you shared so much, and I appreciate it. And wanted to know, although I do have many questions, I think I'll just ask you this last one, and that is, if somebody's struggling, or somebody's married to someone struggling themselves, like, what would be any overall messages that you'd like to share, like, directly?
First of all, there's that saying that there's, like, a slight difference between being alone and being lonely. Being alone is a fact. Like, if I'm alone in this room sitting by myself, so, and there's nothing happening with me in life, no one's involved, so I'm alone. Being lonely is a feeling. It's not like I could sit in a room with 200 people and I could feel lonely at that time, even though there's 200 people around me. So I'm not alone, but deep in my feelings, I feel lonely. My message is that, first of all, whoever's going through these kind of things in life, being an addict and whatever is part of that package of being an addict, and as you guys heard, there's a lot in that package. It's endless. And first of all, you're not alone. Even if you're sitting in that room by yourself, like, you're not alone. I as I said in my thing before, like, I really begged for God, like, to send me one messenger, one angel to, like, understand me, to feel me. I can say that there's a big army outside there, like, troops everywhere, meetings, and they're everywhere. Like, so it's, we just got to do that first step. And I know, I remember that day, it's not in our control. And, like, sometimes it has to be a very, like, big step. Maybe even, like, someone, like, physically has to, like, pull us out of the chair and just stick us in a place where we could, like, you know, just stop for a moment. And at the end of the day, yeah, it's being married and having kids as an addict is it's a plus and a minus. The minus is at the time of the addiction, yeah, there's a lot of responsibility. The fact that the kids were witness to a lot of the things happening. And until today, a lot of times I have to, like, lift up a prayer, and, you know, I pray to God that my kids, in other words, like, if he could, in his own way, somehow delete those parts from their mindset. But it's not reality, I'm saying. But God has his own ways how to do it. And my kids see, again, I can't change anybody around me. I continue changing myself, and my kids see it. Once in a while, they come over to me and they tell me, like, wow, you've changed in this way or another. Every time it's like something else, you're calmer. And the wife, it's a whole different thing. Like, in a certain way, me coming out of rehab, me and my wife, like, in a certain way, we got remarried. That's the feeling. Like, I'm not the same person I was before. And in some place, she's not the same person she was before, because, you know, there's that morning when she wakes up and she discovers, like, it hits her also, like, her husband's sober now, and, like, she doesn't have to take care of him anymore. Like, she could start being herself also. How much energy it takes of the other person in the marriage, being married to an addict. They don't have time to be themselves either. It's always around us, the addicts. The whole picture is always around us. And being sober is not, it's not only for me. Like, thank God I'm in a different place today. But as I said, my wife is also in a different place today. Like, she has time for herself to, like, when I came out of rehab, she, in the first few months, she had that feeling like she always wants to go out with friends, and I understood why. Like, I stuck her in their house, not physically, but she knew that she can't leave me alone with the kids at that time. So she feels, like, relieved. And a half a year being sober, she flew with a friend to Guatemala, I think it was. And, yeah, she was there for 2 weeks, and I felt so happy for her. Like, in some way, I could give back something minimum for the time. But in other words, everything's possible. It's possible. Like, I never dreamt of me being in this chair I'm sitting down now. Like, also the chair of life I'm now in, and this chair sitting next to Moshe Chanin. It's amazing. I'm saying it's a miracle, but we have to allow the miracle to happen, and we have to do something, even very small, with a very, very small, like, little will, wanting to do it, because, as I say, like, even if 1,000 people are going to stand on line outside, like, pushing their hands out to help us, and we don't accept the help, we're not willing to help ourselves, so they're not going to be able to help us. There's this little thing with that water bottle. Like, you go to the supermarket, and the water bottle costs 50 cents. And then you go to the gym, and that same water bottle costs $2. You go to the theaters, and it costs $3. And you go to some stadium, it costs $4, and it's the same water bottle. And the only thing that changes the value of that water bottle is the location it's in. So if you ever feel that you're worthless, and you feel like you're really worth nothing, it might just be that you're in the wrong place. And that's what the program taught me. People, places, things, it's the biggest change I've ever done in my life. Even people that, they don't have to use. They're not addicts. But they made me feel, for years, being around them, they made me feel like nothing. Like they see through me. And that was part of the damage that happened to me through life. It was just being around the wrong people, in the wrong places, doing the wrong things. And today is time to change that. So sometimes we just got to get out of our place, and go to a different place, and then we realize how much value we have, how other people see who we really are. And that's what I've done in life. I moved out of Crown Heights, and it's like, I live in a different world today in Israel. Like, even if people know what I've been through in life, and I don't mind saying my story, it's the opposite. Like, it's today, it's my mission to pass down the message, like in the 12th step. And people at the end, they realize, like, I have to cross the world to the other side. And over there, I started a new life. At the end, after a long journey there as well, I get to that point where I love myself. And if I can't love myself, other people can't love me. And it's something that took me time. I had to build. But at the end of the day, you put yourself in the right place and people get to know who Mendy really is. And that's what's important for me. If I can have myself for me, then other people can have myself for them also. If it's my wife, my kids, family, friends around me, people I work with, it's today they know who Mendy is. I just say the things straight up. I'm not scared to say the word no anymore. And there's plenty more to it. But yeah, it's you learn how to stand on those 2 feet and say exactly what you want to say with some tact. It doesn't harm, but at the end of the day, yeah, I paid a lot of prices in life because I didn't know how to say no to people. So my message to those people that are married or have kids, that kind of situation, being an addict, is there's a lot of hope out there. I didn't see it until a year, 3 months and 28 days ago. There's plenty of it outside. Just got to open our eyes and allow to accept it. Because once we allow it to come in us, it can change our whole life. And that's what it's doing to me today.
That's beautiful, man. On behalf of all of us, first of all, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
For trusting whoever is going to listen to his, myself, and on behalf of the Shamas, we thank you. And yeah, we bless you with many, many more years of freedom.
Amen.
And personal growth and improving your life.
Amen. Thank you very much for hosting me. It's been strong. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening. Please share your feedback by emailing us at podcast@neshamas.org. We hope you'll be back for the next episode of the Neshamas Podcast. This is Moshe Khanan wishing you a healthy and a meaningful day.